ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, at the completion of the fifth day and the third test in the Ashes series. Australia 3, England 0. The urn retained at the earliest possible stage before Christmas. Paul, there's a whole lot to pick apart. First of all, Ed Cowan, it's great to see you.
Corb, you know, of the last seven Ashes series in Australia, six of those, do you know what the score's been at Christmas?
3-0.
3-0. So this is not a an unusual occurrence, it's fair to say. So that's every 4 years. Mm. So essentially anything in this century, we've gone to Boxing Day and it's been 3-0.
Might have to bring back Kerry O'Keefe's stand up if you're 3-0 up, and sure enough the Aussies are in the same position again at this particular stage. It was a fantastic test match. Like there's a lot to pick apart here, but an hour after lunch on day five, Scott Boland picked up the last wicket, an 82-run victory. There might have been a few moments where the most optimistic England fans were starting to think, is this on? Is this a possibility? And yet it felt like the same old themes appeared at the moment we thought England were about to do something great. Jamie Smith, I mean, just mind-numbing after hitting back-to-back boundaries, you know, slogged Mitchell Starc off a length and holed out. And then, yeah, Manus Labuschagne inserted himself in the game, took another superb catch, which I'm sure we'll touch on. And ultimately, Archer cutting out to the deep, caught, and Boland picks up the last wicket, and the Aussies win and get home by 82 runs. We spoke to Manus post-play, and he basically was asked about, you know, how nervy did you get? He said, oh, I was nervous as hell out there. And yet, I kept thinking to myself, if I was in the batting dressing room, I'd be thinking, damn, we're miles away. Like, we got the lower order, and yet for some reason at 150 as the fielding team, I'm feeling a little nervy. Were you at any stage, Teddy, as a former Australian cricketer, about a little apprehensive about this result on the fifth day?
I think there was a little bit of a pulse, no doubt, and when they had four wickets in hand and only, 130 to get, and Jamie Smith was batting as comfortably as he was, and particularly against the second new ball, that, you know, the wicket was flat. Australia's off spinner was off with a bad hamstring. And so you thought, if ever there's a chance, if they just be sensible and kind of take this game into the last session, then the last hour, even if they need 60 or 50 in the last hour, the panic that would have set in with Australia, they just had to take the game deep. And they didn't. You know, the back-to-back fours off Smith, the new ball was coming on, and then he did something stupid, and he touched on it. Every time England got a little sniff, a little scent of what victory could actually be, they just handed back the advantage. And so, you know, we saw again all those little cracks emerge as to how they play the game. They showed excellent resolve, they gave themselves a chance, and of course, as we've talked about, they did so by actually just playing proper cricket. This was an excellent test match. High quality cricket played on a fantastic wicket in front of a great crowd. Mm. You couldn't ask for anything more the week before Christmas.
It was awesome. It was awesome. So 11 days, Australia clinch the urn. I mean, I've just come back up from downstairs. We had all the initial reactions, and the Australians, yeah, quite rightfully jubilant. They did it in a very different way, probably, than even the planning had illustrated. So it's a huge tick for planning and for the selectors and for everything that this group has put into this series. But they also had to be extremely flexible and be able to roll with the punches, because there were a lot of them. I mean, if you look at Pat Cummins misses the first two games, that wasn't part of the planning. Nathan Lyon only bowled two overs in Perth. He was left out in Brisbane. He then gets injured down the stretch in Adelaide. Josh Hazlewood didn't play at all. And then Steve Smith, who's, you know, arguably still your premier batsman, misses in Adelaide. And yet through all that, in 11 days, the equal quickest time, they've retained the urn. That it's alongside the 2001 team and the 2002-03 teams in terms of, you know, start to finish, how quick they were able to make sure it stays in Australia's keeping.
Yeah, it speaks to a couple of things. One, clearly squad depth. Two, how poor England have been. And three, actually the seasoned cricketers that Australia produces. And, you know, that plays into point one. But those that came into the team did their job. They didn't let anyone down. And even, you know, watching Scott Boland go to work, you know, late on day four and day five, you know, that's 10, 12 years of first-class cricket experience of what happens when the wicket gets flat at the MCG. I'm just going to click that gear in. I'm going to bowl with discipline. I'm giving nothing away. I'm going to build pressure. So, and the same can be said for many of the players that stepped up, maybe not get the accolades of a Stark or a Head or a Carey, but they're match-hardened cricketers. And, you know, they stepped into a team that needed them.
NISA in Brisbane, like you spoke about.
You beat me to the punchline. So it's not just this test. Let's look across the series and you talk about NISA and Doggett and the like. And it's been a real, you know, squad-like mentality. So it was an excellent performance from the Australians, how they went about their work. They didn't, maybe their heart was fluttering, but you never got a sense they were in a state of panic.
It's an interesting study in the selectors too, who we, you know, we call balls and strikes. We call it as we see it. And there's times where we've sort of been puzzled and they've had a blind spot trying to find a replacement at the top of the order. Weatherwood, more often than not, I think they got enough out of him. I mean, he's still obviously going to want to drive home that impression for the remaining two test matches and still yet to really bed down that place in the lineup. But as you said, going to NISA at the particular stage they did, not playing line, which was a bold call in Brisbane. And then even leaving out Khawaja, which was a huge call. And in the end, they lose Smith. He comes in, fulfills a role in the middle order, performs for them. So they've pulled the right rein at the right time, and they had to make a lot of decisions here. It wasn't as simple as, hey, let's roll out our best team and let them cook. That they were able to pivot at a moment's notice. So a moment's notice. So hats off to them.
They made their money, for sure. They know their cricket, they're good people, they're sensible, and often we might not agree with the thinking, but there's always thinking behind it. They're not pulling names out of a hat. And so the planning and preparation and everything that goes into a series like this, because they would have wargamed a whole range of scenarios. What happens if Hazelwood doesn't play? What happens if Cummins or Smith, or for whatever reason, we want to maybe not play Usman in the first two tests. Whatever that may have happened, they would have had a whole range of scenarios. Yeah. So long gone are the days where this is, oh, who do we pick this game? This is months of planning, and they reap their rewards.
I love testing my... This is the great thing about being a sports broadcaster, is essentially you get to talk about the topics that you'd be chatting with your mates at the pub anyway, and yet I get to run my theories by former Australian cricketers and people as intelligent as you, Teddy, and know the game inside out. So it's one of the great thrills of the job. I was thinking about Andrew McDonald when I was out for my very slow shuffle this morning, and I thought, there's a chance when he finishes coaching the Australian cricket team, and remembering that, you know, cricket coaches have only really been a thing for the last 30 or 40 years, he could be Australia's greatest cricket coach by the time that he's done. And when you think about the T20 team has never been better placed than they are right now, and we've spoken about that, how strong that unit is. They really should have two World Test Championship titles. They've got one, but they've lost one of their last 12 Test matches, and it just so happens to be the World Test Championship final to South Africa. They've already won the 50-over World Cup, and we'll get a chance to defend that at the end of this bonkers 24 months, which is coming up, which includes the T20 World Cup, so the culmination of what that team's been building to. Then they Bangladesh at home for two, South Africa away, redemption tour, first time since sandpaper. They come home, they play New Zealand, not as big, go to India for five. So that is a glamour series. And as we've spoken about, India is not the force that they once were at home. So perhaps a huge opportunity for the core of this group to tick a huge box there. Then they come back. They've got the 150-year anniversary test against England. Then they go to England. And then at the end of that year, it's off to Africa for the 50-over World Cup. So as much as it feels like sort of this team is sort of reaching its peak here, McDonald's got this fascinating point ahead of him now where, you know, do you try and take this group through these glamour series over the next 24 months and then we all go out together, and if it falls off a cliff, it falls off a cliff? Or is part of his legacy going to be how he turns this team over during this 24-month period? Like, can he just ride it through with this group, and when it finishes, it finishes? Or do you think we'll judge him in retrospect as to what he turns this team into over the next 24 months?
And that's all assuming that he wants to coach for the next 2
Correct.
Years.
Correct.
He's got a youngish family, and it takes its toll across 3-4 months of the game. So he may well have looked at this series and thought, you know, this is my series to go out on a high and you know, let someone else do it. So putting that conversation to one side and kind of taking the question head on, And it's the right question. I think it'll be a mix, and I think you've kind of given the guardrails of what is possible at one end or the other. He's eyeing off, in the very short term, the T20 World Cup, then the Indian Series, then the Ashes, then the rest is real periphery stuff. And so I think they'll start thinking about the Indian Series as the next banner series. These guys have been building for subcontinental tours, have been taken on A-tours and Sri Lankan test tours. They may end up at the end of this summer just popping their head up and playing games of test match cricket, knowing that we need to get some cricket in them, even though the team's in a great shape, and taking a bit more of a portfolio approach to how can we make sure that our returns are strong over the medium term and not fall off a cliff. So that's the algorithm that they're going to have to run. I don't think they're in the business of running this team to the ground. I think that would be a mistake. I think they know that that's a mistake, and I don't think that's good for Australian cricket, and it's probably not good for this team, because there's going to have to be some turnover and there's going to be some natural attrition. Khawaja, yeah. Lyon, probably Lyon. In the very short term, by looks of things. And then whether it's Hazelwood gets managed for white ball cricket, Stark is at his peak of his powers and loves red ball cricket, so maybe he gravitates to there. He's obviously signalled that already.
Yeah.
And then it's a question of Cummins and how you get the best out of Steve Smith. So I think it will be a juggle between formats, and it'll be on a case by case kind of player basis as well.
Yeah, he's not a big talker. We don't hear a heap from him.
Which we love.
Yeah, he does. He's sort of him. Correct, and that's it. I feel like in a way it probably should be more that it's sort of in moments like this we try and give people their flowers when it's due, and he's one. Someone who deserves their flowers is Pat Cummins, isn't it? Like, there's a guy that hasn't bowled a competitive ball since July. He comes out here, bowls big overs, bowled over 30 overs. At one point, he bowled 3 overs up front this morning. I thought, oh, maybe he's sore. He's had a big workload. That'll be it. He was just changing ends. He swung around and decided to bowl up top and came on from the cathedral.
The end. Yeah.
He's a weapon, and he takes 6 wickets in this match. And you just like, how do you? So this is the thing that I'm going to need you to try and explain to me, Teddy. Right. So we hammer England for their lack of preparation. Right. Pat Cummins' preparation is not perfect. I mean, he's a much more skillful player. Clearly, his peak is much higher than a lot of his opponents, and we saw that on display. How can he come out and do that cold, and yet we're basically saying, hey, the reason England haven't performed is because their prep wasn't up to snuff?
Well, because there's a body of work underneath the last 3 or 4 months. So if you look at the England attack, there's no one there that's been doing this for nigh on 14 or 15 years. This is a guy that's been finely tuned for a very long period of time, knows what he needs to get right. And so you couldn't ask the same of Jofra Archery. He hardly plays first class cricket. He hardly plays test cricket. He, you know, is constantly injured. You know, the cotton wool approach hasn't necessarily worked. And you can kind of look through the list and say, you know, at times they've built that foundational kind of stone for their house. Pat Cummins has got his house. He's just got to walk in the front door.
Yeah.
And so it's just a very different thing for him to know when he's ready. And I'm sure if he didn't feel ready, he wouldn't have said, hey, I'm good to go. If that was off rhythm in the nets, he wouldn't have wanted to play and let anyone down. So the fact that he bowled at full tilt and terrorised everyone a few weeks ago, he knew that he was going to be right. And, you know, the Australian training sessions come with an intensity, when they are there, that is probably above match intensity. And you can't imagine England turning up to their net sessions, you know, with their suntans or sunburns with the same intensity. It's just a different prospect.
What does Nathan Lyon's hamstring mean? So 40-minute rain delay, comes out, chasing a ball as hard as he could to the boundary line, and then his string went on him. He left the ground, had a scan, came back. He was on crutches at the end of the day, so it didn't look like his standard 21-day hammy. That slapped some ice on that and he'll be right to go. So I hope for Nathan Lyon's case it's not as serious as it looks, but I think what we know for sure, Teddy, I'm not expecting to see him in the remainder of this series.
Oh, I think you can put a line through that. I'm probably thinking bigger picture and thinking, is this the end of his career, without being too fatalist? It didn't look good. He's got a pretty long history now of soft tissue injuries, you know, towards this back end of his career. You know, the quality of of his impact is fading, although he did, you know, bowl well in favourable conditions. And so you're probably thinking, can we utilise Nathan Lyon on that tour of India, and how can we get him there and manage him through? And it may mean that he misses, you know, a home series in between, perhaps. And he becomes the second spinner, and that's the last bastion for him. And you don't really rely on him the way they have to be the guy. And you can kind of sense that they've been fading that out anyway. So, you know, not picking him in Brisbane, not picking him in the West Indies, you know, bringing other spinners through the system, they feel in a pretty good place if that was the end, I think. But yeah, Let's hope it's not, and he still has some cricket to play.
I also wonder too, like, if I wonder if, you know, if Khawaja does go, say, at the end of the series, a lot of people are anticipating that. He hasn't actually, by the way, said that he wants to finish publicly. Maybe he's having different conversations privately, but all you can do is take him on his word on that front. So he's in the team at the moment. Travis Head is not the most dynamic fieldsman. I wonder if, you know, is there a way that we can nurse him a little bit more rather than in fielding in all the hotspots? Like, he's still the point fieldsman, Nathan Lyon, at this stage of his career, and he's outfielding. And, yeah, maybe that has to change. Maybe we have to go, you know what, we need to sort of chill him out at mid-on, and that means maybe we need to put a couple of these other guys, might need to step up in the hot zones. And if, you know, Khawaja goes out and you get someone who's a bit more, got a little more spring in their step, perhaps, maybe that's, maybe that all helps him out a little bit too to get him a little further.
Yeah, unfortunately in Test cricket, there's, you know, more specialist positions in a sense, given the catches behind the wickets. And so then, given your quorum of fast bowlers, if one of your fast bowlers isn't fielding in the slips, you gotta find some space somewhere. So yeah, I get the premise, but it's sometimes easier said than done.
Manus Labuschagne, speaking of the cordon.
Oh, here we go.
What a Test match for him. Not one, but two rippers with the left hand. The one today in particular, which was Alex Carey's catch, and yet Manus jumped in front of him and bang, straight in the left hand underneath the floppy wide brim hat. He told us post game on Grandstand Cricket he was wearing it almost as a bit of a joke. He said, I remember Michael Clarke used to be a sharp slip fieldsman and he wore the floppy hat, so I thought, oh, I'll try and do that. And sure enough, he thought, man, this is working. This is some kind of special magic hat that I'm wearing that's all of a sudden making him stick. He was awesome, wasn't he?
Stuck in the Michael Clarke left hand, who, you know, he took a few in his time as well. I mean, timely. So I was, without, you know, name dropping 15 minutes into the pod, I had a coffee with a bloke called Mike Hussey this morning. And the topic of conversation for much of it was Manus Labuschagne appreciation. And it was more about the psychology of how infectious his love of cricket and the big moment is. And, you know, part of the conversation was around, you can tell a lot about a person and how they come back after they have been dropped, and we've covered that before. But it was more around, he wants to be in the game and he finds ways to be in the game. So even when he's describing as, I was feeling a little nervy, 99% of test players, and not just professional cricketers, if they're feeling a little nervy and they're standing at slip, they're thinking, I mean, I want the ball to come to me and I'll take it if it comes, but there's no way I'm diving in front of the keeper. That's the keeper's catch. Manus, I want the ball. And he launched himself with conviction and courage and pulled off a moment that was absolutely spectacular and will stick in the memory of many, many Australians because of it. He wants to be in the game and you have to love that. So the team is better with, we've said this all summer, the team is better with Manus in it. And it's great that he's there and he, you know, the journey that he's been on. But that was spectacular.
It's so well summed up. He's just the type of cricketer that every team craves, that he's involved, as you said, engaged every ball. And just the moments of levity too, where he's talking about shampoos and conditioners and onions on burgers and calling Nathan Lyon Phil, which I thought was just excellent, that the boys had dubbed him Phil after his comments up in Brisbane, where he said he was filthy. And so then every time he's rolling it out, instead of being Gaz, he was well bowled Phil. So they were excellent. We had Manus post game, and he basically said, look, as much as, you know, it's 3-0, we want it to be 5-0. So he's got his eyes on that. And he wasn't sort of taking the moment to be too reflective. And the other great quote came from Travis Head downstairs, where he said, Ron Ball is purring. Of course, talking about the great Andrew McDonald and the Ron Ball for the Aussies as they wrap up the urn. I'm sure we'll talk so much about Boxing Day. We've got an extended episode to come tomorrow, obviously, a Monday drop. And it feels like we've bumped so many topics over. But the first thing, I mean, they're going to need to find a spot for Steve Smith. And Nathan Lyon's going to make way. And I get the feeling, unlike Steve Smith's test debut, it's not going to be like for like. He's not going to come in and bowl his leggies and bat at eight. So there's going to need to be a little bit of rearranging.
There will be some rearranging. And, yeah, let's shift that to tomorrow because there's so many permutations and combinations. We've got to give people something to listen to as well. You know, we can't use all our good stuff on a Sunday night. I mean, the only other topic worth covering for me is what a great event. The Adelaide Oval wicket is perfect. Damien Hoff, the best groundsman in the world, bar none, in my mind, did another fantastic job. The predictability of him being able to say, this is how the wicket's going to play, and sure enough, that's exactly what you get. The event around it, so many people travel for the Adelaide Test now that the aura around it being, you know, the great Test match of Australia, given, you know, the members out the back, and there's, you know, the week before Christmas. And so it was a great spectacle. It was excellent. If we were to wrap, I don't know how it felt at the ground, but yeah, it was awesome to watch. And I was a little bit jelly that I wasn't there, to be fair.
Yeah, it was awesome. It just everything that you said was absolutely on point. And I mentioned this as part of the broadcast, and I spoke to you off air about it earlier today. And I was remembering back when I got into my room last night about how I felt when I walked into my room on day zero, which is the day before the test match starts. And the events of Bondi were obviously fresh in the mind and everything of what was going on, and our sympathies, you know, limitless to the people whose, you know, lives have been irrevocably changed after that you know, horrible attack. But it gave us a reminder this week about what it feels like when we're all pulling in the same direction. And it was awesome to be able to feel that again, to feel part of a community, to feel like there's lots of good people in the world and everybody's here having a good time, whether you're an England supporter or an Australian supporter. And I almost felt guilty for it. I think I said that to you on the phone earlier, that I get to be here and experience this while, you know, so many families have been broken at the time of the year where everybody should feel together and feel loved. And so that while my sympathies are ongoing to them, I feel very lucky that I got to experience this week in the way that I did.
Yeah, nicely put. I mean, don't feel guilty. I think that's, you know, a nice reflection, and the joy of live sport is it brings people together and the sense of community of moving forward. So this was another example of that, and long may it continue, Corb.
The folly of you know, bats and balls and the sport that obviously we cover here on the podcast. Last word before we get out of here. How should the England dressing room feel? Should they be leaving Adelaide on an upswing, feeling like, oh, we've got the fight and we can compete with the Aussies, and if something broke this way, we would have won? Or should they leave here feeling like the mission was to go home with the urn, and ultimately we got two more games of cricket to play and we know already that we're not doing that?
It's a tricky one, and you know what caught my eye? I saw a quote from Zach Crawley, I think, overnight. It's like, oh, if we win the next two, 3-2 makes it a pretty good series. Like, mate, 3-2 doesn't make it a great series if you lose the first three. The other two, I mean, they're not tokenistic, but, you know, there's something to play for, and they haven't won a test here for so long, by all means, but they'd be feeling slightly buoyed with what happened and how they went about it. And if they can just package that up and repeat it in Melbourne for a little longer, maybe they could win. But I think underneath there's this, you know, underlying lack of confidence. And it's a bit of a veneer that Bazball has been able to cover up, and it's kind of been exposed now. And that vulnerability would probably be hurting them a little bit in their stomach right now. They've worked out probably that they're not as good as they probably thought they were, and they've been exposed. And so, you know, you can respond in two ways. You either get better or you keep going down the same path. So if they pick up those lessons that they hopefully have learned and apply them, I think, you know, we're in for a good test match for sure.
98-99. I don't know if you remember that series, Teddy. You would have been a young emerging cricketer coming through the ranks, and the Aussies won away from home in 97. They retained the urn after three test matches in the 98-99 series. They went to Boxing Day. It poured on day one. There wasn't a single ball bowled as Matt Nicholson made his test debut. Mm. And then Dean Headley bobbed up to take 6 for 60 in the fourth innings of the match. Australia lost 6 for 22. They needed another 12 runs. They didn't get them. And England, despite the fact the urn had already been lost, they were able to come out and pull off a victory at the MCG. So maybe for British fans out there that are looking for a bit of optimism heading into Christmas, maybe you can wind it back to 98, 99.
Two names I didn't expect you to bring up today, Matt Nicholson and Dean Headley. But I'm glad you did. We're richer for it. Well done.
I missed you yesterday, and we're talking about Botev Dipinar. So it's been a big couple of days for throwback cricketing names. Teddy, awesome to see you. I've got to get to Perth. I'm going there for Christmas, which will be a whole lot of fun. And then the Big Bird, obviously, over for Boxing Day. We'll be chatting tomorrow. By the time happens, I'll be in another time zone again. So it's going to be a big night, I get the feeling, here in Adelaide for the Aussie boys. Hats off to them. I'll chat to you tomorrow. Appreciate your time, as always.
Later. They deserve to let their hair down, Corp. The beer taps of Adelaide might run dry.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.